how distracted you were? That damn bracelet you wore, the note on the wall, all those times when I thought I had you and then suddenly lost you again. It was you, he said, turning to Aspen. Your Majesty, this is my fault, Aspen lied. I pursued her. She made it perfectly clear that she had no intentions of being in a relationship with anyone but you, but I went after her anyway. Without responding to Aspen's excuses, he walked right up to him, looking him in the eye. What's your name? Your first name? He swallowed. Aspen? Aspen Ledger, he said, testing the words. Get out of my sight before I send you to New Asia to die. Aspen's breath caught. Your Majesty, I... go! Aspen looked at me once, then turned and walked away. I stood there, silent and still, afraid to risk a peek into Maxon's eyes. When I finally did, he nudged his chin toward my room and I went in with him following me. I turned to see him close the door and run his hand through his hair one time. He moved to face me, and I saw his eyes catch on the unmade bed. He laughed humorlessly to himself. How long? He asked quietly, still in control. Do you remember that fight? I started. Maxon erupted. We've been fighting since the day we met, America. You'll have to be more specific. I shook where I stood. After Chris's party. His eyes widened. So basically since he got here, he said, something like sarcasm in his voice. Maxon, I'm so sorry. At first I was protecting him, and then I was protecting myself. And after Marley was caned, I was afraid to tell you the truth. I couldn't lose you, I pleaded.
Lose me? Lose me? He asked, astonished. You're going home with a small fortune, a new cast, and a man who is still pursuing you. I'm the one losing here today, America.
The words took my breath away. I'm going home? He looked at me as if I was an idiot for asking.
How many times am I supposed to let you break my heart, America? Do you think I'd honestly marry you, make you my princess, when you've been lying to me for most of our relationship? I refuse to torture myself for the rest of my life. You might have noticed I get plenty of that already.
I erupted into sobs. Maxon, please. I'm sorry, it's not what it looked like. I swear, I love you. He sauntered up to me, his eyes dead.
Of all the lies you've told me, that's the one I resent the most.
It's not. The look in his eyes silenced me.
Have your maids do their best. You should go out in style.
He walked past me, out the doorway, and out of the future I'd held in my hands only a few minutes before. I turned back to the room, holding my stomach as if the core of my body was about to crack from the pain. I went over to the bed, rolling onto my side, no longer able to stand. I cried, hoping to get the ache out of my body before the ceremony. How was I supposed to face that? I looked to the clock to see how much time I had, and saw the thick envelope Maxon had given me last night. I decided this was the last piece of him I would ever have, so I opened the seal, desperate.
Chapter 29, December 25th, 4:30 p.m. Dear America, it's been 7 hours since you left. Twice now I've started to go to your room to ask how you liked your presence, and then remembered you weren't here. I've gotten so used to you, it's strange that you aren't around, drifting down the halls. I've nearly called a few times, but I don't want to seem possessive. I don't want you to feel like I'm a cage to you. I remember how you said the palace was just that the first night you came here. I think over time you've felt freer, and I'd hate to ruin that freedom. I'm going to have to distract myself until you come back. I decided to sit and write to you, hoping maybe it would feel like I was talking to you. It sort of does. I can imagine you sitting here smiling at my idea, maybe shaking your head at me as if to say I'm being silly. You do that sometimes, did you know? I like that expression on you. You're the only person who wears it in a way that doesn't come across like you think I'm completely hopeless. You smile at my idiosyncrasies, accept that they exist, and continue to be my friend. And in 7 short hours, I've started to miss that.
I wonder what you've done in that time. I'm betting by now you've flown across the country, made it to your home, and are safe. I hope you are safe. I can't imagine what a comfort you must be to your family right now. The lovely daughter has finally returned. I keep trying to picture your home. I remember you telling me it was small, that you had a treehouse, and that your garage was where your father and sister did all their work. Beyond that, I've had to resort to my imagination. I imagine you curled up in a hug with your sister, or kicking around a ball with your little brother. I remember that, you know, that you said he liked to play ball. I tried to imagine walking into your house with you. I would have liked that, to see where you grew up. I would love to see your brother run around or be embraced by your mother. I think it would be comforting to sense the presence of people near you. Floorboards creaking and doors shutting. I would have liked to sit in one part of the house and still probably be able to smell the kitchen. I've always imagined that real homes are full of the aromas of whatever's being cooked. I wouldn't do a scrap of work, nothing having to do with armies or budgets or negotiations. I'd sit with you, maybe try to work on my photography while you played the piano. We'd be fives together, like you said. I could join your family for dinner, talking over one another in a collection of conversations instead of whispering and waiting our turns. And maybe I'd sleep in a spare bed or on the couch. I'd sleep on the floor beside you if you'd let me. I think about that sometimes, falling asleep next to you. I mean, like we did in the safe room. It was nice to hear your breaths as they came and went, something quiet and close, keeping me from feeling so alone. This letter has gotten foolish, and I think you know how I detest looking like a fool. But still, I do. For you. Maxon. December 25th, 10:35 p.m. Dear America, it's nearly bedtime and I'm trying to relax, but I can't. All I can think about is you. I'm terrified you're going to get hurt. I know someone would tell me if you weren't all right, and that has led to its own kind of paranoia. If anyone comes up to me to deliver a message, my heart stops for a moment, fearing the worst. You are gone. You're not coming back. I wish you were here. I wish I could just see you. You are never getting these letters. It's too humiliating. I want you home. I keep thinking of your smile and worrying that I'll never see it again. I hope you come back to me, America. Merry Christmas. Maxon. December 26th, 10 o'clock a.m. Dear America, miracle of miracles, I've made it through the night. When I finally woke up, I convinced myself I was worried for nothing. I vowed that I would focus on work today and not fret so much about you. I got through breakfast and most of a meeting before thoughts of you consumed me. I told everyone I was sick and am now hiding in my room writing to you, hoping this will make me feel like you're home again. I'm so selfish. Today you will bury your father, and all I can think of is bringing you here. Having written that out, seeing it in ink, I feel like an absolute ass. You are exactly where you need to be. I think I already said this, but I'm sure you're such a comfort to your family. You know, I haven't told this to you, and I ought to have, but you've gotten so much stronger since I met you. I'm not arrogant enough to believe that has anything to do with me, but I think this experience has changed you. I know it's changed me. From the very beginning, you had your own brand of fearlessness, and that has been polished into something strong. Where I used to imagine you as a girl with a bag full of stones, ready to throw them at any foe who crossed her path, you have become the stone itself. You are steady and able, and I bet your family sees that in you. I should have told you that. I hope you come home soon so I can. Maxon. December 26th, 7:40 p.m. Dear America, I've been thinking of our first kiss. I suppose I should say first kisses, but what I mean is the second, the one I was actually invited to give you. Did I ever tell you how I felt that night? I wasn't just getting my first kiss ever. It was getting to have that first kiss with you. I've seen so much, America, had access to the corners of our planet, but never have I come across anything so painfully beautiful as that kiss. I wish it was something I could catch with a net or place in a book. I wish it was something I could save and share with the world, so I could tell the universe, this is what it's like. This is how it feels when you fall. These letters are so embarrassing. I'll have to burn them before you get home. Maxon. December 27th, noon. America. I might as well tell you this, since your maid will tell you anyway. I've been thinking of the little things you do. Sometimes you hum or sing when you walk around the palace. Sometimes, when I come up to your room, I hear the melodies you've saved up in your heart, spilling out the doorway. The palace seems empty without them. I also miss your smell. I miss your perfume drifting off your hair when you turn to laugh at me, or your scent radiating on your skin when we walk through the garden. It's intoxicating. So I went to your room to spray your perfume on my handkerchief, another silly trick to make me feel like you were here. And as I was leaving your room, Mary caught me. I'm not sure what she was looking after since you're not here, but she saw me, shrieked, and a guard came running in to see what was wrong. He had his staff gripped and his eyes flashed threateningly. I was nearly attacked, all because I missed your smell. December 27th, 11 o'clock p.m. My dear America, I've never written a love letter, so forgive me if I fail now. The simple thing would be to say that I love you. But in truth, it's so much more than that. I want you, America. I need you. I've held back so much from you out of fear. I'm afraid that if I show you everything at once, it will overwhelm you, and you'll run away. I'm afraid that somewhere in the back of your heart is a love for someone else that will never die. I'm afraid that I will make a mistake again, something so huge that you retreat into that silent world of yours. No scolding from a tutor, no lashing from my father, no isolation in my youth has ever hurt me so much as you separating yourself from me. I keep thinking that it's there, waiting to come back and strike me. So I've held on to all my options, fearing that the moment I wipe them away, you will be standing there with your arms closed, happy to be my friend, but unable to be my equal, my queen, my wife. And for you to be my wife is all I want in the world. I love you. I was afraid to admit it for a long time, but I know it now. I would never rejoice in the loss of your father, the sadness you've felt since he passed, or the emptiness I've experienced since he left. But I'm so grateful that you had to go. I'm not sure how long it would have taken for me to figure this out if I hadn't had to start trying to imagine a life without you. I know now, with absolute certainty, that is nothing I want. I wish I was as true an artist as you, so that I could find a way to tell you what you've become to me. America, my love, you are sunlight falling through trees. You are laughter that breaks through sadness. You are the breeze on a too warm day. You are clarity in the midst of confusion. You are not the world, but you are everything that makes the world good. Without you, my life would still exist, but that's all it would manage to do. You said that to get things right, one of us would have to take a leap of faith. I think I've discovered the canyon that must be leaped, and I hope to find you waiting for me on the other side. I love you, America. Yours forever, Maxon. Chapter 30. The great room was packed. For once, instead of the king and queen being the focal point of the room, it was Maxon. On a slightly raised platform, Maxon, Chris, and I sat at an ornate table. I felt as if our positioning was deceitful. I was on Maxon's right. I always thought being on someone's right was a good thing, an honored position. But so far, he'd spent the entire time speaking to Chris, as if I didn't already know what was coming. I tried to seem happy as I looked around the room. It was packed. Gavril, of course, was in a corner, speaking into a camera, narrating the events as they happened. Ashley smiled and waved, and beside her, Anna winked at me. I gave them a nod, still too nervous to speak. Toward the back of the room, in deceptively clean clothes, August, Georgia, and some of the other northern rebels sat at a table by themselves. Of course, Maxon would want them here to meet his new wife. Little did he know she was one of their own. They surveyed the room tensely, as if they feared any second a guard would recognize them and attack. The guards didn't seem to be paying attention, though.
In fact, this was the first time I'd ever seen them look so poorly focused, eyes meandering around the room, several of them on edge. I'd even noticed that one or two hadn't shaved and looked a little rough. It was a big event, though. Maybe they were just rushed. My eyes flitted over to Queen Amberlee, speaking with her sister Adele and her gaggle of children. She looked radiant. She'd been waiting for this day for so long. She would love Chris like her own. For a moment, I was so jealous of that fact. I turned and scanned the faces of the selected again, and this time my eyes landed on Celeste. I could see the clear question in her eyes. What are you so worried about? I gave her a minuscule shake of my head, letting her know that I'd lost. She sent me a thin smile and mouthed the words, "It'll be okay." I nodded, and I tried to believe her. She turned away, laughing at something someone said, and I finally looked to my right, taking in the face of the guard stationed closest to our table. Aspen was distracted, though. He was looking around the room like so many of the other men in uniform, but he seemed to be trying to think of something. It was as if he was doing a puzzle in his head. I wished he would look my way, maybe try to explain wordlessly what he was worried about, but he didn't.
"Trying to arrange a time to meet later?" Maxon asked, and I whipped my head back.
"No, of course not."
"It's not like it matters. Chris's family will be here this afternoon for a small celebration, and yours will be here to take you home. They don't like for the last loser to be alone. She tends to get dramatic."
He was so cold, so distant. It was as if it wasn't even Maxon at all.
"You can keep that house if you want. It's been paid for. I'd like my letters back, though."
"I read them," I whispered. "I loved them." He huffed as if it was a joke.
"Don't know what I was thinking."
"Please don't do this. Please. I love you." My face was crumpling.
"Don't you dare," Maxon ordered through gritted teeth. "You put on a smile, and you wear it to the last second."
I blinked away the tears and gave a weak smile.
"That'll do. Don't let that slip until you leave the room. Do you understand?"
I nodded. He looked into my eyes.
"I'll be glad when you're gone."
After he spat out those last words, his smile returned, and he faced Chris again. I stared into my lap a minute, slowing my breathing and putting on a brave face. When I brought my eyes up again, I didn't dare to look directly at anyone. I didn't think I could honor Maxon's last wish if I did. Instead, I focused on the walls of the room. It was because of that I noticed when most of the guards stepped away from them at some signal I didn't see. Pieces of red fabric were pulled out of their pockets and tied across their foreheads. I watched in confusion as a red-marked guard walked up behind Celeste and put a bullet squarely through the back of her head. The screaming and gunfire exploded at once. Guttural shouts of pain filled the room, adding to the cacophony of chairs screeching, bodies hitting walls, and the stampede of people trying to escape as fast as they could in their heels and suits. The men shouted as they fired, making the whole thing more terrifying. I watched, stunned, seeing death more times in a handful of seconds than ought to be possible. I looked for the king and queen, but they were gone. I was gripped with fear, unsure if they'd escaped or been captured. I looked for Adele, for her children. I couldn't see them anywhere, and that was even worse than losing sight of the king and queen. Beside me, Maxon was trying to calm Chris.
"Get on the floor," he told her. "We're going to be fine."
I looked to my right for Aspen and was in awe for a moment. He was on one knee, taking aim, firing deliberately into the crowd. He must have been very sure of his target to do that. Out of the corner of my eye, I saw a flicker of red. Suddenly, a rebel guard was standing in front of us. As I thought the words "rebel guard," it all clicked into place. Anne had told me this had happened once before, when the rebels had gotten the guards' uniforms and had sneaked into the palace. But how? As Chris let out another cry, I realized that the guards who were sent to our houses hadn't abandoned their posts at all. They were dead and buried, their clothes stolen and standing in front of us. Not that this information did me any good now. I knew that I should run, that Maxon and Chris should run if they were going to make it. But I was frozen as the menacing figure raised his gun and directed it at Maxon. I looked up at Maxon, and he looked to me. I wished I had time to speak. I turned away, back to the man. A look of amusement crossed his face, as if he suspected this would be much more entertaining for himself and much more painful for Maxon. He slid his gun ever so slightly to his left and aimed it at me. I didn't even think to scream. I couldn't move at all, but I saw the blur of Maxon's suit coat as he leaped toward me. I fell to the ground, but not in the direction I thought I would. Maxon missed me, flying across in front of me. When I hit the floor, I looked up to see Aspen. He'd sprinted to the table and pushed over my chair, crashing on top of me.
"I got him," someone shouted. "Find the king."
I heard several shouts of delight, pleased with the declaration, and screaming. So much screaming. As I came out of my stupor, the sounds crashed into my ears again. Other chairs and bodies clamored to the floor. Guards yelled out orders, shots were fired, and the sickening pops pierced my ears. It was pure pandemonium.
"Are you hurt?" Aspen demanded over the commotion.
I think I shook my head.
"Don't move."
I watched as he stood, widened his stance, and aimed. He fired several times, eyes focused and body at ease. By the angle of his shots, it looked like more rebels were trying to get close to us. Thanks to Aspen, they failed. After a quick survey, he popped down again.
"I'm going to get her out of here before she really loses it."
He crawled over me and grabbed Chris, who was covering her ears and crying in earnest. Aspen pulled her face up and slapped her. She was stunned into silence long enough to listen to his orders and follow him from the room, shielding her head as she went. It was getting quieter. People must be leaving now, or dying. And then I noticed a very still leg hanging out from under the tablecloth. Oh, God. Maxon. I scurried under the table to find Maxon breathing with great labor, a large red stain growing across his shirt. There was a wound below his left shoulder, and it looked very serious. "Oh, Maxon," I cried. Unsure of what else to do, I balled up the hem of my dress in my hands and pressed it to the bullet wound. He winced a bit. "I'm so sorry." He reached up his hand and covered mine.
"No, I'm sorry," he said. "I was about to ruin both our lives."
"Don't talk right now. Just focus, okay?"
"Look at me, America."
I blinked a few times and pulled my gaze up to his eyes. Through the pain, he smiled at me.
"Break my heart. Break it 1,000 times if you like. It was only ever yours to break anyway."
"Shh," I urged.
"I'll love you until my very last breath. Every beat of my heart is yours. I don't want to die without you knowing that."
"Please don't," I choked. He took his hand off mine and laced it through my hair. The pressure was light, but it was enough for me to know what he wanted. I bent to kiss him. It was every kiss we'd ever had. All the uncertainty, all the hope. "Don't give up, Maxon. I love you. Please don't give up." He took an unsteady breath. Aspen ducked under the table then, and I squealed in fear before I realized who it was.
"Chris is in a safe room, Your Majesty," Aspen said, all business. "Your turn. Can you stand?"
He shook his head.
"A waste of time. Take her."
"But Your Majesty..."
"That's an order,"
he said as forcefully as he could manage. Maxon and Aspen stared at each other for a long second.
"Yes, sir."
"No, I won't go," I insisted.
"You'll go,"
Maxon said, sounding tired.
"Come on, Mayor, we have to hurry."
"I'm not leaving." Quickly, as if he might suddenly be fine, Maxon reached up to Aspen's uniform and clutched it in his hands.
"She lives. Do you understand me? Whatever it takes, she lives."
Aspen nodded and grabbed my arm harder than I thought possible.
"No," I cried. "Maxon, please."
"Be happy,"
he breathed, squeezing my hand one last time as Aspen dragged me away, screaming. As we got to the door, Aspen pushed me up against the wall.
Shut up. They'll hear you. The sooner I get you to a safe room, the sooner I can come back for him. You have to do whatever I say. Got it?
I nodded.
Okay, stay low and quiet, he said, pulling out his gun again and dragging me into the hall.
We looked up and down and saw someone running away from us at the far end of the corridor. Once he was gone, we moved. Around the corner, we stumbled upon a guard on the ground.
Aspen checked his pulse and shook his head.
He reached over and grabbed the guard's gun and handed it to me.
What am I supposed to do with this? I whispered, terrified.
Fire it, but make sure you know if it's a friend or a foe before you do. This is mayhem.
It was a tense few minutes of ducking into corners and checking safe rooms that were already taken and locked. It seemed that most of the action had moved upstairs or outside, because the pops of gunshots and faceless screams were muffled by walls. Still, each time we heard a whisper of a sound, we paused before moving.
Aspen peeked around a corner. This is a dead end, so keep a lookout.
I nodded. We moved quickly to the end of the short hallway, and the first thing I noticed was the bright sun coming in through the window. Didn't the sky know the world was falling apart? How could the sun shine today?
Please, 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 Aspen whispered, reaching for the lock.
Mercifully, it opened.
Yes,
he sighed, pulling back the door, blocking half the hall from view.
Aspen, I don't want to do this.
You have to. You have to be safe for so many people. And I need you to do something for me.
What?
He fidgeted.
If something happens to me, I need you to tell.
Over his shoulder, a hint of red came from behind the corner at the end of the hall. I jerked the gun up and pointed it past Aspen, firing at the figure. Not a second later, Aspen pushed me into the safe room and slammed the door, leaving me alone in the dark. Chapter 31. I don't know how long I sat there. I kept listening for something outside the door, even though I knew it was useless. When Maxon and I had been locked in a safe room a few weeks ago, we couldn't hear a single sound from the outside world, and there had been so much destruction then. Still, I hoped. Maybe Aspen was okay and would open the door at any second. He couldn't be dead. No, Aspen was a fighter. He'd always been a fighter. When hunger and poverty threatened him, he pushed back. When the world took away his dad, he made sure his family survived. When the selection took me, when the draft took him, he didn't let it stop him from hoping. Compared to all that, a bullet was tiny, insignificant. No bullet was taking down Aspen Ledger. I pressed my ear up to the door, praying for a word, a breath, anything. I focused, listening for something that sounded like Maxon's labored breathing as he lay dying underneath the table. I pinched my eyes together, begging God to keep him alive. Certainly everyone in the palace would be looking for Maxon and his parents. They would be the first ones helped. They wouldn't let him die. They couldn't. But was it past hope? It looked so pale. Even the last squeeze of my hand was weak. Be happy. He loved me. He really loved me. And I loved him. In spite of everything that should have kept us apart, our castes, our mistakes, the world around us, we were supposed to be together. I should be with him, especially now while he lay dying. I shouldn't be hiding. I stood up and started feeling around the walls for the light switch. I slapped the steel until I found it. I surveyed the space. It was smaller than the other room I'd been in. It had a sink but no toilet, just a bucket in one corner. A bench was pressed up against the wall by the door, and a shelf with some packets of food and blankets lined the back. And then, finally, on the floor, the gun sat cold and waiting. I didn't even know if this would work, but I had to try. I pulled the bench over to the middle of the room and tipped it on its side, with the wide seat propped up toward the door. I crouched below it, checking the height, and realized that wasn't going to be much cover. It would have to do, though. As I stood, I tripped over my stupid dress. Huffing, I hunted on the shelves. The thin knife was probably for opening and dividing food, but it worked on the material just fine. Once my dress was cut into an uneven hem around my knees, I took some of the fabric and made a makeshift belt and tucked the knife in it for good measure. I pulled the blankets over myself, expecting there to be some sort of shrapnel. Looking one more time around the room, I tried to see if there was anything I should take with me, something I could repurpose. No, this was it. Ducking behind the bench, I aimed the gun at the lock, took a steadying breath, and fired. The sound echoed in the tiny space, scaring me even though I'd been expecting it. Once I was sure that the bullet wasn't ricocheting around the room, I went up to check the door. Above the lock, a small crater sat, exposing rough layers of metal. I was upset that I'd missed, but at least I knew this might work. If I hit the lock enough times, maybe I could get out of here. I hid behind the bench and tried again. Shot after shot hit the door, but never in the same place. After a while, I got frustrated and stood up straight, hoping it would help. All I managed to do was get my arms cut by pieces of the door flying back at me. It wasn't until I heard the hollow click that I realized I'd used all the bullets and was stuck. I threw down the gun and ran over to the door. I hit it with all the force of my body. Move! I rammed into it again. Move! I hit the door with my fists, accomplishing nothing. No, 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 I have to get out! The door stood there, silent and severe, mocking my heartbreak with its stillness. I slid down to the floor, crying now that I knew there was nothing I could do. Aspen might be a lifeless body only feet away from me, and Maxon, surely by now he was gone. I curled my legs to my chest and rested my head against the door. If you live, I whispered, I'll let you call me your dear. I won't complain, I promise. And then I was left to wait. Every so often I'd try to guess at the time, though I had no way of knowing if I was right. Each sluggish minute was maddening. I'd never felt so powerless, and the worry was killing me. After an eternity, I heard the click of the lock. Someone was coming for me. I didn't know if it was a friend or not, so I pointed the empty gun at the door. It would at least look intimidating. The door creaked open, and the light from the window glared in. Did that mean it was still the same day? Or was it the next? I held my aim, though I had to squint to do so.
Don't shoot, Lady America, a guard pleaded. You're safe.
How do I know that? How do I know you're not one of them? The guard looked down the hall, acknowledging an approaching figure. August stepped into the light, followed closely by Gavril. Though his suit was practically destroyed, his pin, which I now realized looked an awful lot like a North Star, still hung proudly on his bloody lapel. No wonder the Northern rebels knew so much.
It's over, America. We got them, August confirmed.
I sighed, overwhelmed with relief, and dropped the gun. Where's Maxon? Is he alive? Did Chris make it? I asked Gavril, before focusing again on August. There was an officer. He brought me here. His name is Officer Ledger. Have you seen him? The words tumbled out almost too quickly to be understood. I was feeling funny, lightheaded.
I think she's in shock. Take her to the hospital wing quickly, Gavril ordered,
and the guard scooped me up easily. Maxon? I asked. No one answered. Or maybe I was gone by then. I couldn't remember. When I woke up, I was on a cot. I could feel the stings of my many cuts now, but as I picked up my arm to inspect it, the cuts were all clean, and the larger ones were bandaged. I was safe. I sat up and looked around, and realized I was in a tiny office. I inspected the desk and the diplomas on the wall, and discovered it was Dr. Ashler's. I couldn't stay here, I needed answers. When I opened the door, I discovered why I'd been tucked away. The hospital wing was packed. Some of the less injured were placed two to a bed, and others were on the floor between them. It was easy to tell that the worst were in beds toward the back of the room. Despite the number of people, the space was remarkably quiet. I scanned the area, looking for familiar faces. Was it good not to find them here? What did that mean?
Tuesday was in a bed holding on to Emeka as they cried quietly. I recognized a few of the maids, but only vaguely. They nodded their heads at me as I passed, as if I somehow deserved it. I started losing hope as the crowd started to thin. Maxon wasn't here. If he was, he'd have a swarm of people around him, jumping to meet his every need. But I'd been placed in a side room. Maybe he had, too. I saw a guard, and his face was scarred, from what I couldn't guess. "Is the prince down here somewhere?" I asked quietly. Solemnly, he shook his head. "Oh. A bullet wound and a broken heart would seem like two different injuries, but I could feel myself bleeding out, just as surely as Maxon had. No amount of pressure or stitching would ever fix this. Nothing would ever stop the ache. I didn't break into a scream, though it felt as if something similar was happening inside. I just let the tears fall. They didn't wash anything away, but they felt like a promise. Nothing will ever replace you, Maxon, and I sealed our love away.
Mare?
I turned and saw a bandaged figure in one of the last beds in the wing. Aspen. My breathing hitched as I took unsteady steps toward him. His head was bandaged and there was blood staining its way through. His chest was bare and bruised in several places, but the worst part was his leg. A thick cast was wrapped around the bottom, and several bandages were sloppily placed over gashes on his thigh. Wearing nothing but some shorts and a bit of a sheet over his other leg, it was easy to see how badly he'd been wounded. "What happened?" I whispered.
"I'd rather not relive the details. I made it for a long time, and I took out maybe 6 or 7 of them before one got my leg. The doctor says I'll probably be able to walk on it, but I'll need a cane. At least I'm alive."
A tear continued silently down my cheek. I was so grateful and scared and hopeless, I couldn't help it.
"You saved my life, Mare."
My eyes flew from his leg to his face.
"The shot you took spooked that rebel and gave me just enough time to fire. If you hadn't done it, he would have shot me in the back, and that would have been it. Thank you."
I wiped my eyes. "It was you who saved my life. You always have. It's about time I started paying you back." He smiled.
"I do have a tendency for heroics, don't I?"
"You always wanted to be someone's knight in shining armor." I shook my head, thinking over everything he'd ever done for anyone he loved.
"Mare, listen to me. When I said that I'd always love you, I meant it. And I think if we had stayed in Carolina, we would have gotten married, and we would have been happy. Poor, but happy."
He smiled sadly.
"But we didn't stay in Carolina. And you've changed. I have too. You were right when you said that I'd never given anyone else a chance, and why would I have ever bothered except for all this happening? It's my instinct to fight for you, Mare. It took me a long time to see that you didn't want me to do that anymore. But once I did, I realized I didn't want to fight for you either."
I stared at him, stunned.
"You'll always have a piece of my heart, Mare, but I'm not in love with you anymore. I think sometimes that you still need me or want me, but I don't know if that's right. You deserve better than me being with you because I feel obligated."
I sighed. "And you deserve better than being someone I settle for." He held out his hand to me, and I took it.
"I don't want you to be mad at me."
"I'm not. It's good to know you're not mad at me. Even if he is dead, I still love him."
Aspen's forehead creased. "Who's dead?"
"Maxon," I breathed, ready to cry again. There was a pause.
"Maxon's not dead."
"What? But that guard said he wasn't here and..."
"Of course he's not here. He's the king. He's recovering in his room."
I lunged to hug him, and he grunted at the impact of my embrace, but I was too happy to be cautious. Then the happy and sad news mixed together. I stepped back slowly. "The king died?" Aspen nodded.
"The queen, too."
"No." I shuddered, blinking again. "She said I could call her mom. What was Maxon going to do without her?"
"Actually, if it hadn't been for the northern rebels, Maxon might not have made it either. They were really the tipping point.
They were?
I could see the wonder and appreciation in his eyes.
We should have had rebels training us. They fight differently. They knew what to do. I recognized August and Georgia in the Great Room. They had backup outside the palace walls. Once they realized something was wrong, well, they already have a talent for getting into the palace quickly. I don't know where they got the artillery from, but we'd all be gone without them.
I could hardly take in all this. I was still putting the pieces together when the opening door disturbed the quiet murmurs in the wing. A worried face surveyed the room, and though her dress was torn and her hair was tumbling down around her face, I recognized her immediately. Before I could call out to her, Aspen did.
"Lucy," he cried, sitting up. I knew the motion had to hurt him, but there was no sign of pain in his face.
"Aspen," she gasped and ran across the wing, hopping over people as necessary. She fell into his arms, kissing his face over and over. While he grunted in pain when I'd hugged him, it was clear that in this moment, Aspen wasn't feeling anything but pure happiness.
"Where were you?" he demanded.
"Fourth floor. They're only now reaching the rooms up there. I came as fast as I could. What happened?"
Though she was usually so panicked after rebel attacks, Lucy seemed focused now, seeing only Aspen.
"I'm fine. What about you? Do you need to see the doctor?"
Aspen looked around, trying to find some help.
"No, I don't even have a scratch," she promised. "I was just worried about you."
Aspen stared into Lucy's eyes with absolute devotion.
"Now that you're here, everything's right."
She stroked his face, careful not to disturb his bandages. He put a hand behind her neck and gently pulled her to him, kissing her deeply. No one needed a knight more than Lucy, and no one could protect her better than Aspen. They were so lost in each other, they didn't notice me walk away, heading off to find the one person I really wanted to see.
Chapter 32. Leaving the hospital wing, I got my first look at the palace. It was hard to process the destruction. So much broken glass strewn across the floor, glittering hopefully in the sunlight. Ruined paintings, parts of the wall blown out, and menacing red stains on the carpets reminded me of how close we'd all been to death. I started up the stairs, trying to avoid eye contact with anyone. As I passed from the second floor to the third, I noticed an earring on the floor. I couldn't help but wonder if its owner was still alive. I made my way to the landing and saw a number of guards as I walked toward Maxon's room. I supposed it was unavoidable. If I had to, maybe I'd call out to him. Maybe he'd tell them to let me pass, just like the night we met. The door to Maxon's room was open, and people buzzed in and out, bringing in papers or taking away platters. Six guards lined the wall leading up to the door, and I braced myself for the brush off. But as I got closer, one of the guards noticed me. He squinted, as if double-checking that I was who he thought I was. Beside him, another guard recognized me, and one by one they bowed, deeply and reverently. One of the guards by the door extended an arm.
"He's been waiting for you, my lady."
I tried to be someone deserving of the honor they were giving me. I stood taller as I walked, though my scratched arms and cut-off dress did nothing to help.
"Thank you," I said with a gentle nod.
A maid rushed past as I went in. Maxim was on his bed, the left side of his chest padded with gauze under his plain cotton shirt. His left arm was in a sling, and he used his right to hold up the paper some advisor was explaining to him. He looked so normal there, dressed down, hair a mess, but at the same time, he looked like so much more than he had been before. Was he sitting a little taller? Had his face somehow become more serious? He was so clearly the king.
"Your Majesty," I breathed, falling into a low curtsy. Standing, I saw the quiet smile in his eyes.
"Set the papers here, Stavros. Would everyone please leave the room? I need to speak with the lady."
Everyone circling around him bowed and headed toward the hall. Stavros quietly placed the papers on Maxon's bedside table, and as he passed, he winked at me. I waited until the door closed before I moved. I wanted to run to him, to fall into his embrace and stay there forever. But I moved slowly, worried that maybe he regretted his last words to me. I'm so sorry about your parents.
It doesn't seem real yet,
he said, motioning that I should sit on the bed.
I keep thinking that Father is in his study and Mom's downstairs, and any minute one of them will come in here with something for me to do.
I know exactly what you mean. He gave me a sympathetic smile.
I know you do.
He reached out and put his hand on mine. I took that as a good sign and held his hand back.
She tried to save him. A guard told me a rebel had my father in his sights, but she ran behind him. She went down first, but they got Father immediately after.
He shook his head.
She was always selfless, to her very last breath.
You shouldn't be so surprised. You're a lot like her. He made a face.
I'll never be quite as good as her. I'm going to miss her so much.
I rubbed his hand. She wasn't my mother, but I would miss her as well.
At least you're safe,
he said, not looking into my eyes.
At least there's that.
There was a long stretch of silence, and I didn't know what to say. Should I bring up what he said? Should I ask about Chris? Would he even want to think about any of this now?
There's something I want to show you,
he suddenly announced.
Mind you, it's a bit rough, but I think you'll still like it. Open the drawer here, he instructed. It should be on the top.
I pulled out the drawer in his bedside table, noticing a pile of typed papers right away. I gave Maxon a questioning look, but he just nodded toward the writing. I started reading the document, trying to process what it said. I got to the end of the first paragraph and then reread it, sure I was mistaken. Are you? You're going to dissolve the casts? I asked, looking up to Maxon.
That's the plan, he answered, smiling. I don't want you to get too excited. This will take a long time to do, but I think it will work. You see, he said, turning the pages of the vast file and pointing to a paragraph, I want to start from the bottom. I'm planning on eliminating the 8 label first. There's a lot of construction we need to do, and I feel like, with a little bit of work, the 8s could be absorbed into the 7s. After that, it gets tricky. There's got to be a way to get rid of the stigmas that come along with the numbers, but that's my goal.
I was awestruck. I'd only ever known a world in which I wore my cast like a piece of clothing. And here I was, holding something saying that those invisible lines we'd drawn between people could finally be erased. Maxon's hand touched mine.
I want you to know that this is all you're doing. Since the day you called me into the hallway and told me about being hungry, I've been working on this. It was one of the reasons I got so upset after you did your presentation. I had a quieter way of reaching the exact same goal. But of all the things I wanted to do for my country, this would never have crossed my mind if I hadn't known you.
I took in a breath and gazed at the pages again. I thought over the years of my life, so short and fast. I'd never expected to do more than sing in the background of people's house parties and maybe get married one day. I thought about what this would mean for the people of Ilia, and I was beside myself. I felt both humbled and proud.
There's something else,
Maxon said hesitantly as I continued to take in the words in front of me. Then, suddenly on top of the papers, Maxon slid over an open box with a ring resting in it, shining in the light cascading through his windows.
I've been sleeping with that darn thing under my pillow,
he said, sounding playfully irritated. I looked up to him, not saying anything, as I was still too stunned to speak. I was sure he could read the questions in my eyes, but he had his own to address.
Do you like it?
A web of thin gold vines crawled up, forming the circle of the ring, holding at the top 2 gems, one green, one purple, that kissed at the crown of it. I knew the purple one was my birthstone, so the green one must be his. There we were, 2 little spots of light growing together, inseparable. I meant to speak and opened my mouth several times to try. All I could manage to do was smile, blink back my tears, and nod. Maxon cleared his throat.
Twice now, I've tried to do this on a grand scale and failed spectacularly. As it is, I can't even get on one knee. I hope you won't mind if I just speak to you plainly.
I nodded. I still couldn't find a word in my entire body. He swallowed and shrugged his uninjured shoulder.
I love you, he said simply. I should have told you a long time ago. Maybe we could have avoided so many stupid mistakes if I had. Then again, he added, beginning to smile, sometimes I think it was all those obstacles that made me love you so deeply.
Tears pooled in the corners of my eyes, balancing on my lashes.
What I said was true. My heart is yours to break. As you already know, I'd rather die than see you in pain. In the moment I was hit, when I fell to the floor, sure my life was ending, all I could think about was you.
Maxon had to stop. He swallowed, and I could see he was as close to tears as I was. After a moment, he continued.
In those seconds, I was mourning everything I'd lost. How I'd never get to see you walk down an aisle toward me. How I'd never get to see your face in our children. How I'd never get to see streaks of silver in your hair. But at the same time, I couldn't be bothered. If me dying meant you living.
He did his one shoulder shrug again.
How could that be anything but good?
At that, I lost my control, and the tears came in earnest. How had I ever thought that I knew what it meant to be loved before this very second? Nothing had come close to this feeling radiating in my heart, filling every inch of me with absolute warmth.
America,
Maxon said sweetly, forcing me to wipe my eyes and face him.
I know you see a king here, but let me be clear. This isn't a command. This is a request, a plea. I beg you, make me the happiest man alive. Please, do me the honor of becoming my wife.
I couldn't get out how much I wanted this, but where my voice failed, my body succeeded. I crawled into Maxon's arms, holding on to him tightly, certain that nothing could ever pull us apart. When he kissed me, I felt my life settle into place. I had found everything I'd ever wanted, things I didn't even know I was looking for, here in Maxon's arms. And if I had him to guide me, to hold me, then I could take on the world. It seemed too soon our kiss slowed, and Maxon pulled back to look into my eyes. I saw it in his face. I was home. And I finally found my voice. Yes. Epilogue. I try not to shake, but it does no good. Any girl would do the same. The day is big, the dress is heavy, and the eyes watching are uncountable. Brave as I ought to be, I tremble. I know that once the doors open, I will see Maxon waiting for me. So while all the last second details are settled around me, I hold on to that promise and try to relax. Oh, this is our cue, Mom says, noting the change in the music. Sylvia waves my family over. James and Kenna are ready to go. Jared is running around, already wrinkling his suit, and May keeps trying desperately to get him to stand in one place for 2 seconds back to back. Even if he is a bit rumpled, they all look surprisingly regal today. As happy as I am that everyone who loves me is with me, I can't help but feel an ache that Dad isn't here. I feel him, though, whispering how much he loves me, how proud he is, how lovely I look. I knew him so well that I feel like I can pick out the exact words he would say to me today, and I hope it stays like that always, that he'll never really be gone. I'm so lost in my daydreams that May sneaks up on me. You look beautiful, Ames, she says, reaching up to touch the intricate high collar of my dress. Mary outdid herself, didn't she? I answer, touching parts of the dress myself. Mary is the only one of my original maids still with me. When the dust settled, we found out so many more lives were lost than we guessed at first. While Lucy made it through the attack and chose to retire, Anne was simply gone. Another empty place today that ought to be filled.
My gosh, Ames, you're shaking!
May grabs my hands and tries to still them, laughing at my nerves. I know, I can't help it.
Marley, May calls, come help me calm America down.
My one and only bridesmaid walks over, her eyes as bright as ever, and with the two of them surrounding me, I do start to feel less tense. Don't worry, America, I'm sure he'll show up, she teases. May laughs, and I swat at them both. I'm not worried he'll change his mind. I'm afraid he'll trip or mispronounce his name or something. I have a talent for messing things up, I lament. Marley puts her forehead on mine. Nothing could mess up today. May, Mom hisses. Okay, Mom's losing it. See you up there. She gives me a ghost kiss on my cheek, making sure not to leave a lipstick smudge, and goes on her way. The music plays, and they walk together around the corner and down the aisle that's waiting for me. Marley steps back. Am I next? Yes, I love this color on you, by the way. She juts out her hip, posing in the gown. You have great taste, Your Majesty. I suck in a breath. No one's called me that yet. Oh, goodness, that's going to be my name to pretty much everyone. I try to adjust to the words quickly. The coronation is part of the wedding. First the vows to Maxon, then the ones to Ilya. Rings, then crowns. Don't start getting nervous again, she insists. I'm trying. I mean, I knew it was coming. It's just a lot for one day. Ha, she exclaims as the music shifts. Wait until tonight. Marley! Before I can scold her, she scampers away, winking as she goes, and I'm forced to giggle. I'm so glad to have her back in my life. I officially made her one of my attendants, and Maxon did the same for Carter. It was a clear sign to the public of what was coming with Maxon's reign, and I was happy to see how many people welcomed the change. I listen, waiting. I know the notes are coming soon, so I take one last chance to straighten my dress. It's truly magnificent. The white gown is fitted through my hips, flitting out in waves to the floor. The lace sleeves are short and lead to a high collar that genuinely makes me look like a princess. Over the dress, a sleeveless cape-like coat flows out behind me, making a train. I'll take it off for the reception, where I intend to dance with my husband until I can't stand anymore.
Ready, Mare?
I turn to Aspen. Yes, I'm ready. He holds an arm out for me, and I put mine through his.
You look incredible.
You clean up pretty nice yourself, I comment. And though I smile, I know he sees my nervousness.
There's nothing to worry about,
he assures me, that confident smile making me believe that whatever he says is true, same as always. I take in a deep breath and nod. Right. Just don't let me fall, okay?
Don't worry. If you look unsteady, I'll hand you this.
He holds up the deep blue cane, specially made to match his dress uniform, and the idea makes me laugh.
There we go, he says, happy to see me genuinely smile.
Your Majesty? Sylvia asks. It's time. Her tone is slightly odd. I give her a nod, and Aspen and I make our way to the doors.
Knock 'em dead,
he says, just before the music rises and we're revealed to the guests. All the fear rushes back. Though we tried to keep the guest list small, hundreds of people line the aisle that will take me to Maxon. And as they all rise to greet me, I can't see him. I just need to see his face. If I can find those steady eyes, I'll know I can do this. I smile, trying to stay calm, graciously nodding at our guests, thanking them for their presence here today. But Aspen knows.
It's okay, Mare.
I look to him, and the encouragement in his expression helps. I keep moving. It's not the most graceful parade down the aisle. It's also not the fastest. With Aspen's leg so injured, we have to hobble our way slowly to the front. But who else could I have asked? Who else would I have asked? Aspen had shifted to fill a desperate place in my life. Not my boyfriend, not my friend, but my family. I had expected him to say no, afraid it was somehow an insult. But he'd said he was honored and embraced me when I'd asked. Devoted and true, even to the very end. That's my Aspen. Finally, I see a familiar face in the crowd. Lucy is there, sitting with her father. She beams with pride for me, though really she can hardly tear her eyes off Aspen. He stands a little taller as we pass her. I know that soon it will be her turn, and I'm looking forward to it. Aspen couldn't have made a better choice.
Beside her, filling up the closest rows, are the other selected girls. It was brave of them to come back for me, considering not everyone who should be here is. Still, they smile. Even Chris, though I can see the sadness in her eyes. I'm shocked by how much I wish Celeste was here. I can imagine her rolling her eyes and then winking or something like that, making some wisecrack that was almost snotty but not quite. I really, really miss her. I miss Queen Amberlee, too. I can only imagine how happy she would have been today, finally getting a daughter. I feel as if marrying Maxon makes it okay for me to love her that way, like a mother. I'm certain I always will. And then there's my mom and May, holding on to each other so tightly they look as if they're supporting each other. Around them are so many smiles. It's almost overwhelming how loved I feel. I'm so distracted by their faces that I forget how close I am to the end of the aisle. As I turn forward, he's there. And then it seems as if no one else is here at all. No cameras filming, no bulbs flashing. It's just us. It's just Maxon and me. He's wearing his crown, and the suit with the blue sash and the medals. What did I say the first time he wore it? Something about hanging him up with the chandeliers, I think. I smile, remembering the long journey that got us here, standing at the altar. Aspen's last few steps are slow but steady. When we reach our destination, I turn to him. Aspen gives me one last smile, and I reach over to kiss his cheek, saying goodbye to so many things. We share a look for a moment, and he takes my hand and puts it in Maxon's, giving me away. They nod to each other, nothing but respect in their faces. I don't think I could ever understand all that's passed between them, but it feels peaceful in that moment. Aspen steps back, and I step forward, arriving at the one place I never thought I'd be. Maxon and I move close to each other as the ceremony starts.
"Hello, my dear,"
he whispers. "Don't start," I warn in return, and we're both left smiling. He holds my hands as if they're the only things pinning him to the earth, and I focus on that as I prepare myself for the words coming, the promises I'll never break. It's magical, really, the power this day has. But even now, I know this isn't a fairy tale. I know that we'll have hard times, confusing times. I know that things won't always happen the way we want them to, and that we'll have to work to remember that we chose this. It won't be perfect, not all the time. This isn't happily ever after. It's so much more than that. This is Amy Rubinate. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of The One by Kira Cass. This program was produced by Elgin Productions. The director was John McElroy. Executive producer, Caitlin Gehring. Text copyright 2014 by Kira Cass. Production copyright 2014 by HarperCollins Publishers. All rights reserved. Thank you for listening.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.